from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. The genetic underpinnings of disease have received a lot of attention this past decade, with new findings supporting the view that our DNA plays a larger role than once thought in a wide variety of conditions. This week, we learned that five very different psychiatric conditions may share a genetic linkage as well. The study, published in the journal Lancet, found that four genetic abnormalities slightly increase the risk for schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disorder, major depression, and attention deficit disorder. Equally fascinating, those genetic abnormalities may cause bipolar disorder in one person, but perhaps schizophrenia in another. The real significance of these findings may be that they also point to the possibility of diagnosing and treating disease based on your chemistry rather than just your symptoms. The study was led by Dr. Jordan Smoller, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and he joins us for our next half hour. Dr. Smoller, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So describe the essence of this finding, if you would, please, that there may be this linkage between these seemingly very different disorders.
Sure. Well, this was part of the work of a really unique international collaboration called the Psychiatric Genomics Consortium that allowed us to put together genetic data for these five, as you said, very different psychiatric disorders, autism, ADHD, depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. And we asked, are there any specific DNA variations that are associated with the risk, not just for one, but for two, three, four, or even all five of those disorders? And as you suggested, we found several specific variations. These are what we consider common variations, that is, they're not rare mutations, that slightly increase the risk for all five of these disorders, which, as you mentioned, we think of as quite different conditions. And so that was surprising and fascinating to see.
And so does it mean then that there might be a kind of common starting point for many of these conditions that then diverge for other reasons, whether that's other genetic connections or environmental influences? Is that one way to think of this?
I think that is one way to think of it. And, you know, putting it in context, of course, these genetic variations, we think, account for a tiny fraction of the overall genetic component of any of these disorders, because we think that there are hundreds, maybe thousands of genes that contribute in some way to these very complicated conditions. And some of those genetic influences may overlap, may be shared among different disorders, and some may be unique. So as you suggested, there might be some early, general kind of increase in the susceptibility to psychiatric disorders of various kinds that then gets channeled in one way or another based on other genetic or non-genetic risk factors.
We so often read these days about different genetic influences increasing your odds of getting this or that, and so it's always important to be clear about what the risks are. So in terms of these findings, you said they slightly increase the risk. Can you be any more specific, I guess, about what those odds involve?
Sure. So these are risk factors that really account for a tiny fraction. It would be, you know, something less than 1% of the overall genetic risk for these disorders. And what that means is that these are not diagnostic tests. They're not the kind of thing where if you had your genotype and you said, I carry these variants, I'm really at a high risk based on that. So it's not a predictive test. What it does do, more importantly, though, is give us new leads into the underlying biology. And that's where, that's where the follow-up becomes really important, to figure out what some of these variations, as small as their individual contribution might be, are actually doing, and how do they play out biologically.
Dr. Jordan Smoller joining us this hour. He's professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and led the team of researchers looking into this particular question. So if I understand you correctly, the significance here isn't so much that if you found you had these abnormalities that you'd have to be intensely concerned about the prospects of getting one of these conditions. The significance is that it shows that there is some common denominator, and if we can better understand that, that would lead us to a deeper understanding of the what's going on chemically, I guess.
That's perfectly said, yes. And, one of the interesting findings from the study was that there was a particular biological pathway that was pointed to by some of these variants, and that was calcium channel signaling. And what that means is that variants or genes that have to do with these calcium channels that are important for how brain cells communicate with each other seemed to be important to all five of these disorders. So we're actually already getting a biological clue there. And one of the things that raises the possibility of is that if one were to develop a treatment, say, that influenced those calcium channels, it might have broad effects on a variety of symptoms or disorders. Of course, a lot would need to be done to establish that.
So this is, I think, particularly fascinating because we already know that calcium channels, these proteins that, as I understand it, affect the way cells communicate with each other, that plays a role in hypertension. And so there are these calcium channel blockers that are used to treat high blood pressure. And again, this is obviously very, very, very preliminary. But does that mean that there's a possibility that something like a blood pressure drug could be effective in treating one of these disorders?
In theory, that is conceivable, and I think people will be interested to find that out. There's been a little bit of preliminary work along those lines, but it's far from conclusive, and I certainly wouldn't want people to go out and, you know, ask for calcium channel blockers based on them,
right?
Because we're far from anything clinically translatable at that point. But that is the kind of thing we're talking about. That is to get clues from genetic research that can actually let us develop more specific and effective treatments. One of the things that people may or may not know is that the basic treatments that we have for psychiatric disorders now, while they are effective and sometimes life-saving for many people, still don't obviously work for everyone, and they are based on biological insights that have really been around mostly for 40 or 50 years. So what we're hoping that genetic research is going to do is point us in some entirely new directions that we can then capitalize on to develop things that are going to be more helpful to people.
Dr. Jordan Smoller joining us. If you'd like to join our conversation as well, have questions about these findings and what we're learning about the genetic influences and effects on these various disorders, you can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your questions, thoughts, or concerns on our Facebook page or on our website as well. Well, this also has an interesting connection, I think, or at least I'd like to ask you about this, with what's also we're learning about other forms of neurological science and neurological disorders. For example, in Parkinson's disease, we've learned that calcium channels may be involved in that too, that they're sort of get kind of hyperactive in that condition. And there's actually clinical testing going now of a calcium channel blocker called isradipine, and whether or not that, which was formerly for or could be for high blood pressure, might also be effective in Parkinson's. So are we beginning to learn, I guess, that there may be all kinds of interconnectedness between various conditions?
Absolutely. This is one of the fascinating themes that's emerging from genetic and other kinds of research. We've seen this now in, for example, inflammatory and autoimmune disease, where many of the genes that are influential or were discovered in the context of one disorder, say Crohn's disease or rheumatoid arthritis, turn out to have effects in other autoimmune conditions like type 1 diabetes or celiac disease. So sometimes people speak of the diseaseome, which would be kind of the entire spectrum of disease and health. And what we're seeing is that when you gather more information and you begin to learn about the underlying basis of some of these things, there are connections that were largely invisible to us before.
And does that then also mean that there is, just as there are in neurological conditions like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's and others, this desire to find a marker of some sort within our biology that would aid in both the detection and the treatment, so that you're not just basing your diagnosis on symptoms, but you're really basing it on something that you could much more precisely measure and perhaps eventually fix?
Yes, I think so. And I think that's a particularly acute issue for psychiatry because, as you know, all the whole classification of psychiatric disorders is really just based on symptoms and on what folks report and what judgments people make about the predominant problems that are observable, and not with reference to cause. And that has, you know, in some ways served well, but we think that it's, you know, ultimately we want to move beyond that and to be able to understand, approach, and maybe diagnose these disorders in ways that have more to do with the root causes and what's really going on rather than simply the observable symptoms. If you think about, you know, other medical conditions where, say, chest pain is a symptom of many different kinds of things, but if you really want to specifically and effectively treat the underlying disorder, you have to kind of know what kinds of things give rise to chest pain and how are they different. Is it heart disease? Is it pulmonary disease? That kind of thing.
And with some conditions, there is a measurable marker. Let's go back to hypertension. You can slap on a blood pressure cuff and know whether or not the meds you're giving someone are making a difference. Does this open up that sort of possibility as well within psychiatric conditions so that you could have some way of measuring whether or not a medication is working?
Yeah, there is a field of what we call pharmacogenetics, which means the idea that one might use biomarkers, but particularly genetic information, to predict whether somebody is likely to respond well to a medication or have toxicity or adverse effects. And that has worked and is used in some areas of medicine. There's a lot of research in psychiatry trying to develop those kinds of predictors because, as you probably know, most of the treatments that we have now, we have to take a kind of trial and error approach to, and we often wait, for example, for medication treatments, 3-4 weeks, maybe 2 months before we know whether something's working. So if we had some clues early on, we might save people a tremendous amount of suffering and you know, match the right treatment early on. Now, the problem with biomarkers in the realm of psychiatry is that the organ of interest, the thing that is most central to mental illness and psychiatric disorder, is the brain. And measuring things in the brain is very difficult. We can't, you know, take a sample and so on. So people are using things like neuroimaging, brain imaging, to see whether there are predictors that one might be able to develop.
I would also think that in your field, in psychiatry, that you know, when you see a patient and you base your treatment plan on that maybe 1 hour session, but you don't really know what's going on the rest of the time, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this might give you a way of refining that treatment so that it's not just based on how someone is doing Tuesday afternoon at 1 p.m.
It might. And then on the other hand, the flip side of that is that we don't think this is all reducible to a blood test to biology. And there is no substitute for really getting to know a person's particular situation, talking with them about what's going on in their lives that may be triggering some of these things. Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly not advocating that we're going to, you know, get this down to a simple blood test. But right now we are working in many ways through trial and error and through our best guesses. So having more information available that can tell us what's going to be most helpful to people, I think, is really, you know, we can be optimistic about.
Let's hear what some of our listeners want to know about this fascinating new study. Julia joins us first with a question for Dr. Jordan Smoller. Julia, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a pertinent question to myself, and I'm sure to many other people. I have struggled with different addictions throughout my life, starting with an eating disorder, then moving into an exercise disorder, then moving into an alcohol disorder. I have been diagnosed with major affective depressive disorder, and my big question is, would this kind of research tie in or help any of us, more people out there that are suffering with addiction, could there be any answers there?
That's a very good question, and all of the things that you mentioned are areas of research that is really active now in trying to understand the causes, for example, of addictions and of disorders that that are related to, say, obsessive compulsive kinds of behaviors or other kinds of behaviors that are problematic. We know a little bit from family and twin studies that there is likely to be some overlap in the causes of those difficulties with things like depression. And there is, a lot of blurring of lines between these conditions. I think we are still early on in this whole process. You know, the excitement is that we actually are now finding some specific things. But we have to be, as scientists, of course, at the same time, humble that this is a beginning, a part of the picture. There are some findings relevant to genes and things like alcohol overuse that seem to be predictive, but again, to such a small degree that they're not tests that can be really used clinically at this point. So we are sort of at the beginning of this journey, but what I think is encouraging is that we are really seeing some progress.
Julia, thanks so much for the call. Does the old adage that genetics loads the gun but environment pulls the trigger, is that still relevant to all of these sorts of questions, Dr. Smoller?
I suppose so. I mean, I think that it's definitely true. You know, the answer to the question of whether it's nature or nurture is yes. that it's certainly true, and that all of these things involve some combination of genetic vulnerability and environmental or experiential kinds of factors. And it's almost impossible to really tease them out in any particular individual case. But we know that genes work only in an environment. And we also know that in addition to our genomes, there's another parallel code that people are now studying called the epigenome, which has to do with how the environment and sometimes experience can alter the chemistry and expression of our genes. And so even nurture itself, in a way, we are beginning to look at it at a biological level.
Hmm. Martin has a question from San Francisco for Dr. Smoller. Martin, go ahead.
Yeah, hey there. I wanted to ask you about autism spectrum disorders, right? The rate's gone from 1 in 10,000 in the 80s to 1 in 88 today, and still observed and seen as a psychiatric disorder, or something of the brain that has observable behaviors and no known cause and no known treatment. Yet, when we look around the world at the modern science, it seems to be telling us that this is a physiological disorder where the body is affecting the brain, and hence there are things that can be done to intervene and affect the trajectory of this disorder. Hmm. What do you say of that sort of completely different paradigm of observation of the disorder from simply psychiatric to one that is whole body in nature and that can be addressed and altered?
Well, I think you raise a good point. First of all, the point about the sort of dramatic apparent increase, which is still a puzzle in many ways. And I think that clearly there's some degree of diagnostic changes that have really made an important impact in that. I think that you're right also that, you know, when we talk about psychiatric disorders, we don't think of the sort of mind-body distinction in some clear-cut way. That is, we think of these as disorders that affect or are relevant to not only the brain, but also to the whole person. And I think that autism and autism spectrum disorders are clearly a case where genetic variation, we're learning, does play an important role. It is often a condition that involves more than certainly behavior, and in fact involves other kinds of physical symptoms and gastrointestinal symptoms for people often. And the hope is that as we learn something more about that and begin to study this at the level of genetic variation and brain imaging, in addition to sort of behavioral approaches, that we're going to uncover some clues that can allow us to intervene and maybe change the trajectory in ways that we don't know about currently. And so the autism and autism spectrum disorders are an area of intense research. And at least on the genetic side, there has been quite a bit of progress in the last 5 years, thanks to a lot of investment from the National Institutes of Health and others. So I think we are, again, learning quite a bit about the nature of the disorder. And as we learn more about it, we again see these connections to other things and to physical kinds of systems in the body as well.
Martin, thanks for the question. Coming back to your initial point, Dr. Smoller, about the linkage between conditions like autism and others, why might that be that if you had a particular genetic abnormality in these, let's say, in this channel, calcium channel arena, why that might prompt autism in one person, and that same abnormality might prompt major depression or schizophrenia in another?
Well, I think it gets to the hypothesis that you raised earlier, which is that there might be some broad underlying kind of susceptibility that occurs as a result of genetic variation. And when we think about calcium channels, these are channels that are involved in the way nerve cells communicate and also the way they translate electrical signals between them into biological signals within the cells. They're involved in a tremendous array of brain functions, from cognition to emotion processing to fear learning to all kinds of things. So you might imagine that a sort of broad base kind of variation might somehow subtly increase the risk for a variety of things, but that then downstream there are all kinds of other things. The one other point I want to make, though, is, again, you're referring to these as abnormalities. These are actually common variations.
Okay.
And they do confer a very subtle increase in risk. So, the frequency of these variants was about 10 to 30%, say, in the population. So they're not terribly uncommon, but their effects are very
tiny. Well, and that's actually really helpful to know, and I think I was not clear on that. So these are very common variations, mm-hmm. but their impact may be slight. Are there stronger connections between, let's say, schizophrenia and bipolar than there is between autism and depression? Are you able to assess that sort of linkage?
Well, we did look at that a little bit in this study. What we did was we took the sort of totality of the genome-wide data and essentially asked how correlated were the genetic variations that were associated with, say, schizophrenia to one of these other disorders. And we did it for each pair of disorders. And what we did see was a stronger correlation, in this case, between schizophrenia and bipolar disorder than between any other of the pairs of disorders. But we also saw relationships between bipolar disorder and depression, between autism spectrum disorders and schizophrenia. Again, these were small amounts in some cases. But another caveat is that as the study gets larger, you get a clearer picture. And so just a technicality, but the autism and ADHD component of this study was somewhat smaller than the others, so we may have not gotten as precise a picture. Hmm. But yes, we do see varying degrees of relatedness between these disorders. And the schizophrenia bipolar disorder story is interesting because that has been one of the fundamental distinctions in psychiatry for the last century, that these are really two very different things. People don't get that both of those diagnoses. It's really one or the other. And what we're seeing is that they may be, at least at a genetic level, more closely related than we thought.
Alan in Berkeley has a question about schizophrenia in particular as well. Alan, go ahead.
Thank you. I haven't read the study yet. I'm a psychiatrist working in the East Bay. This is a fascinating discussion. I was wondering, and I have for quite some time, about the incidence of schizophrenia worldwide being approximately 1%, according to the studies I used to read. They may have been updated since then, but could it be that nature is hedging its bets on with these genetic variations as a form of adaptability for the unknown, and that these are not, negative mutations, but rather, 1% to clip off of the gene to anticipate any potential, things that might occur in the world that we don't know, but it could become an adaptive advantage.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And actually, there has been some research along those lines. And people have, as you said, estimated the frequency of schizophrenia to be pretty similar around the world. And it raises the question, because we do have some evidence that individuals with schizophrenia may be less likely to have kids. And so does that mean a genetic component would be less likely to be passed on and so on? So there's a lot of interest in that kind of question, and it probably differs for different psychiatric disorders. But one thing that we do see in some cases of genes related to schizophrenia or genetic variation is that they are what we call de novo. That is, they are not necessarily inherited through a family line, but some of them seem to occur spontaneously. These tend to be rare, and they don't account for, say, most cases of schizophrenia. But that question of, you know, how is it that genes that might influence a disorder might still be relatively common? And I think part of the answer may have to do with what you said, especially for certain kinds of conditions, that, you know, these genes are not doing one thing. They also have other functions, and for those other functions, they may become more common because they are promoting aspects of health.
We have to hold it there, Alan, but thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Just have a little bit of time left, Dr. Smoller, but tell us what's next in this, because this obviously is a study that hints at lots of fascinating things, but at this point more a hint than conclusive. So where will research go from here?
Well, in lots of directions simultaneously. So one thing is actually to do larger and larger studies, and this consortium is now increasing in scope and size, and will also be doing studies of post-traumatic stress disorder and obsessive-compulsive disorder, Tourette syndrome, and other conditions. So we'll get a more complete picture. Another line of research will be trying to figure out, having identified some genetic variants, what are they actually doing? How do they play out? What is their biological function? And that brings in studies of, again, brain imaging and cell models and animal models. And then the other thing you mentioned, which is, you know, can we take these clues and use them to screen or develop new treatments? Each of these is a whole story and a long story on its own, but at least we have something that we can begin to move on, thanks to not just this study, but many, many other recent studies in the last few years.
And I guess on this day of the sequester, it's worth noting that there could be some real difficulties, right, with pursuing all of that kind of research without necessarily funds flowing from the NIH.
That is really a concern for people in the research community, and I think for the public health, I think we research is costly and important, and I think we need to find some way to continue, especially at a time now when there's so much exciting going on.
Dr. Jordan Smoller, professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, lead author for the study that we've been discussing during this past half hour of Forum. Dr. Smoller, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for your work as well.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Katie Springer. Our engineer this hour is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.